Welcome to another edition of Politics in the Pulpit, which is a lectionary-based preaching resource designed to ask the tough questions about the next week's lectionary readings and where they collide with what's going on in the real world. I'm Michael Wakelin. I was formerly at the BBC for many years, and I'm now Executive Chair of the Religion Media Centre, and I'm an Executive Producer on Pause for Thought on Radio 2, and I'm also part of the Religion and Belief Literacy Partnership, helping big organisations to accommodate religion in the workplace. I'm very pleased to say, as I was last week, that I'm not the person who's going to be providing the intellectual content for our conversation this morning. That's in the very safe and capable hands of Naomi Nixon. Hello, Naomi. Lovely to have you with us.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
So Naomi is the CEO of the SCM, which is the Student Christian Movement, which has been at the forefront of putting progressive theology into action for over a century. I first became aware of the SCM when I was at university at Birmingham in the theology department, which was famous at the time for a book they brought out called The Myth of God Incarnate, edited by John Hick. And I could certainly vouch for the fact that SCM's publications can be very pioneering and very exciting too. Naomi is also an ordained Anglican priest working as an assistant pioneer minister at St. Clair's at Coventry Cathedral. And you also train clergy, I believe, and you have some very advanced degrees, one in feminist biblical studies, which I hope will shed some light on our readings for next week. And you're currently doing a PhD. And before we go any further, could you just enlighten us onto what your PhD is about?
I shall certainly try. I think I had supervision this week, and it looks like I'm actually going to be finishing it, which is quite exciting after more than a decade. It's about it's particularly about further education chaplaincy. So what is the soul of further education chaplaincy? But the thing that most people kind of outside of that quite niche world are interested in is that I'm writing about a tentative theology, which contrasts with the fact and command style of theology that a lot of theological, particularly academic theological discourse, happens in. And what I'm saying is that the chaplains have developed a highly sophisticated and really important tentative voice, which enables them to be in a completely secular culture and to speak appropriately and to reflect with honesty on who they are and where they are and what God is doing in the context that they're in. And I also propose apprenticeship as a model for chaplaincy. But it's the tentative voice that most people are interested in.
I suppose could the tentative voice become a little bit more confident in time?
So the thing that I say is that it's not unconfident. It's much more about being incredibly aware of your place in the conversation, that you're offering something and not afraid that the person you're offering it to might say no. It doesn't mean you're not confident in what you're saying, but it's saying that actually I might be wrong, that actually I've got a thought and I think it's a good one. It's worth me sharing with you. But it's a conversation and it's undefended about the response that it might receive.
And I was intrigued by your connection with Coventry Cathedral, which is a particular favourite of mine, having visited most of the cathedrals for one reason or another in my career. Also, Coventry is St Michael's, and I was taken to St Michael's at a very early time in my life, and I saw the wonderful bronze outside the cathedral of St Michael defeating the devil, which had a big effect on me at the time. But also, I've been watching This Town on BBC One, a drama, and Coventry Cathedral plays quite an important part in that drama as a centre of inspiration for one of the lead characters who loves the acoustic in the cathedral. But I wanted to mention, I know you haven't seen that series, which is a shame, but I do recommend it to you.
I'm going to. I will do.
In the episode I watched last night, we're not watching it in order, we're tending to binge watch it when we see it. There's a scene where the main character, who's a black man, is one of the main characters, is in a prison cell, police cell, And he's beaten up and called all sorts of ghastly racist terms as he's being thumped. And I was watching it with my 14-year-old son, and I was thinking, this just looks absolutely awful. But of course, it's set not that long ago when police racism and brutality was quite a thing, quite known about, and black people didn't feel at all safe in prison cells. And of course, this week marks the anniversary of the brutal killing of Stephen Lawrence. And the report into that, of course, revealed how embedded racism was in the police force. So I just wanted to draw put a light on that, because I think it's worth remembering how awful that was and how, in many, many ways, things have improved in terms of policing, we hope. Would that be your understanding?
Certainly that that we've come a long way, and that there's we recognize the horror of it and we recognize the truth of it. I pray that it doesn't happen as much as it did, but as a white person, I wouldn't
Yeah,
want
of
to
course.
claim that. But I will say that we're big TV watchers, so I'm definitely going to watch this one. But we've just done a binge watch of all the series of Silent Witness, and one of the things that's been really horrifying about that is watching just the normal background. So it starts in the 1990s, and of course it's contemporaneous, and watching what was normal only a very short time ago. That's not a subject of the. It's just sort of background of the policing and society, and just the way it's reflected, both in terms of racism, sexism, and safeguarding in particular. And in a funny way, although that was kind of horrifying to watch it being normal and not being pointed out as a point in the drama, in a funny way, we found it incredibly, watching it over a few short months and it's accelerating through time, we found it incredibly hopeful in terms of that actually, all of that is time I've been an adult, and things are changing. Things that were normal then, even 10 years ago, are not normal now. And it makes me feel that the work that we do in shining a light on these things, that can so often feel hopeless,
Yeah.
that it's not hopeless.
Okay. So we're going to get on to the reading shortly for this coming Sunday. But just a word, please, about the SCM, the Student Christian Movement, because
Yes.
I'm not sure what it does. And do
Okay.
enlighten us, but don't go on too long, but
No,
I'd love to hear some
understood.
of it.
Understood. So SCM, we're a movement of students and recent graduates, and first and foremost, it's about being a place of belonging for them, of being belonging, and all they need to do is be a part of their group or of the wider movement. But there are opportunities for them to grow and develop and do more with their Christian faith if they want to. SCM was set up at a time when there was no opportunity for lay people to do critical theological study unless they were about to become clergy. And that's and university is a particular time of growth of the intellect. And what SCM's always done through the decades is find ways of offering students of each generation a way to put their powerful brains into the heart of their faith and bring it back to the rest of us and tell us new things. The press was a big part of that in the post-war era when nobody else was publishing these great theologians. And we gave it away in the 80s because it wasn't necessary for us to run it anymore. And SCM travels light. We don't empire build. But so there are local groups in universities, there's national opportunities for growing in progressive leadership in as radical theologians. They write a lot of theologians get their first chance at writing for our blogs and our magazine. But also growing as activists, and I think that's particularly relevant to what we're talking about today. In this generation, a big part of our campaigning is for the LGBTQ plus community. That being a young progressive voice in the church is absolutely vital. And if we'd got more time, I'd tell you more about that. But that's the headline.
So you're still very active, which is great to hear.
Oh, very much so, yes.
Super. Let's look to the readings that are coming up this Sunday to help our viewers and listeners with their service preparation, which is what this is really about. I wondered if you'd come up with an overall theme. There was a certain emphasis that struck me on sheep. Always an interesting topic of conversation. And perhaps if we could start with the psalm, because I think it's always a good place to start, which is Psalm 23 this week. And
Bit of a
I have
gift.
a little story about that from my time at Birmingham University, actually, when we had as our Old Testament lecturer a gentleman called John Eaton, who was the expert on the Psalms. He'd written the definitive book on the Psalms, which is one of our textbooks. And he was a lovely man, and he used to get very carried away, and when he was talking about the Psalms, because he loved them so much, he had a little flask with him all the time that he sipped from. I often wondered whether it was gin, because he always seemed so very happy. I often in one lecture, I said to him, "So, what is your favourite psalm?" You know, getting the definitive answer from the horse's mouth, as it were. And without answering me directly, he paused, took a deep breath, and started to say, "The Lord is my shepherd; I shall not want." And it was a real tear-jerking moment, I
Oh my
found. So
goodness.
it is the best psalm. I mean, according to the
Yeah.
man who really knows. And so that stayed with me. So is it one of your favourites?
It is actually, and I can add a bit of a tear-jerking story. The last time I read it out loud was the night my father died. He was in a hospice in Herefordshire, and I was on Iona, and so there was no possibility of getting back. And I sat in Iona Abbey, and thanks to the miracle of mobile phones, they put me on speakerphone in his room, and my brothers and my mum were sitting with him, and I read this psalm and heard it echo in Iona Abbey as I know it, it landed in my dad's ears about 45 minutes before he died. And it was one of the most profound experiences of my life. And I think that some passages of scripture prickle with the divine, and this is one of them. And it's a favorite because it does. It's not even a cliche. It's just it tells us something of the promises of God in such a visceral way, and it does that every time.
Yeah. And there are some lovely settings of it now. So that's going straight in my readings for Sunday. And we'll also probably sing the beautiful modern setting of it, which I'm very fond of. Okay, so we'll take the Psalm 23 as a given and move on perhaps to the reading from, which is from Acts chapter 4, verses 5 to 12. Interestingly, you know, Pentecost is coming up, and it's taken out of chronological order, this particular story, isn't it? Because it's actually after Pentecost. But here we have the story of Peter and John in trouble with the authorities because of the healing they performed at the beautiful temple gate of a crippled beggar there. What did you make of this?
So I think they're great reading, really great readings this week, but I think this is probably the one I'd preach on. And at St. Clair's, we tend to only preach on one reading. One of the things that really struck me was the confidence that Peter has, that this was the same guy that only a minute ago was running away in fear and pretending he never knew Jesus. And it I think, you know, this is Peter really coming into his own. This is the new Peter. This is the Peter that's going to build the church. And it's just really glorious to see that. And so often we see ourselves in Peter. So I think I'd want to really kind of play with that idea and think about what is it after the resurrection that gives us the confidence for ministry, the confidence to speak of Jesus with certainty, even when we know we're going to get pushback. Or might be, you know, he's actually in danger here. Yeah, so I think that's the first thing. I think there's a kind of a sort of character study around Peter that's really interesting, and I think if your church is one where you commonly talk about the disciples a lot as kind of the proxy for us, then there's a lot of really good stuff to go with. In the first half of the meeting, of the reading in particular, about Peter himself. But then of course we get the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And if it doesn't suggest a song for you, then I don't know what does. I think it's really obvious for me as doing campaigning work about the people of today who are rejected, that what my kind of go-to there would be. I'd be talking about the people who are excluded from church, and it's really important. This is excluded from church. We could also unquestionably think about the people who are excluded in our societies. I think it really struck me looking at the BBC News app this morning, and there was a picture of one of the small boats, because of the kind of next stage of the Rwanda policy, and it, you know, it really struck me that the people who are being rejected and literally trying to be ejected from the country, that clearly there are parallels there that you could really dig into. But in its original context, it is speaking to the religious people about rejecting Jesus from the religious establishment. And it's important for us to hear that challenge, that first and foremost, it is a challenge to church leaders like myself. And to always be asking ourselves, who are we rejecting, and what riches are we pushing away because of that? It's always something to be cautious of, to put ourselves, I'm really comfortable putting ourselves in place of Peter, but putting ourselves in the place of Jesus is always a dangerous thing to do in a sermon. But and of course, first and foremost, this is about rejecting Jesus, but it tells us something of the pattern of inclusion, and the pattern of seeing humility, vulnerability, and something unwanted as actually the heartbeat of faith. And I think there is a lot that the church needs to hear still about that.
Just to pick up on your point about Peter really rising to the occasion, this was a really scary meeting. A little bit of research I did, the guys he was standing in front of were some old rogues from the gospel stories, of course. But you have the rulers, the elders, and the teachers of the law. This was the Supreme Court, and this guy's a fisherman, and he's standing there, proclaiming with such eloquence. But it struck me, as we said last week from the reading from Acts, there's a very early creed in here, isn't there? There's a very familiar lines like, "It is the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead, that this man stands for you, before you healed. He is the stone you builders rejected, which has become the cornerstone. Salvation is found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to people by which we must be saved." That sounds like an early creed that was oft repeated. Imagine Peter had already got these kind of words going around his head, and he could draw on them and bring them out in key moments. So that was one thing I noticed. And yeah, fabulous text to preach on, and thanks for your points about that. I wonder if you can tie them in, going on to the reading from 1 John chapter 3, verses 16 to 24, which very much talks about love being action and things. It's a doing thing, love. What do you think John is teaching us here about God's priorities?
It was really interesting. I tried in the first instance when I was looking at the readings to see what are the different themes, because it's helpful, you know, not everybody's going to want to preach the sermon that I'd preach. So I was thinking, you know, what are the different things that we can pull out? And then they morph back together. and it's hard with them not to do that. So as we'd expect from John, there's an awful lot of love in this passage. But as you say, it's about that love into action. And one of our big phrases at SCM is faith in action. And this is really a reading about that. Because really what John is saying, and I think he's saying it in a really helpful, gentle way, that he asks the question. So rather than saying, you are not really abiding in God's love if you're failing to act for the vulnerable, he's saying, how can you not? He's posing it as a question. And I think this really goes back to the stuff that I'm talking about in my PhD. So David Ford wrote a really helpful chapter in his book, The Future of Christian Theology, called Desire Above All. So the chapter's called Desire Above All. It's my favourite chapter of any theology book ever, because it really opened the way that we look at scripture for me. And this, he talks about different grammatical moods and doing theology in different grammatical moods. And this is a questioning, an interrogative mood that John is writing in. And it's really helpful because it dares us to open up our thinking and not be defensive. And he makes this really powerful point. How does God's love abide in anyone who sees a brother or sister in help and yet refuses help? That if we can, why are we not helping? So I think there's something there which enables us, which so often as preachers is hard to offer challenge in a way that isn't just shaming people. And nobody goes to put love into action out of shame. It's just the wrong dynamic. But this is a way of helping us to think about that flow of the grace of God given to us and on through us and into action. And I think that's really beautiful. And I think the passage that follows, little children, let us love, not in word or speech, but in truth and action. And by this we will know that we are from the truth and will reassure our hearts before him. And then he calls us beloved. And I think it's the way that it isn't just a challenge to love, it's expressed with love. I think that's what I'd hope and pray that my sermon was in the same tone, that it gave that warmth of, we know this is hard. Well, it's hard for all of us to stand up and be like Peter and be brave. Or sometimes we're tired or broke or whatever it might be that holds us back from putting that love into action. But this is a really gentle challenge, which has also got a kind of a steely intellectual kind of heart to it, but it's presented in an empowering way.
Yeah, I detected some comfort for people like me. You know, I'm very self-critical and often down on myself. And there's a nice line in verse 20, isn't there, that says, this then is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence whenever our hearts condemn us. So our hearts condemning us. So, you know, he says, don't worry about that, for God is greater than our hearts and he knows everything. Mm. I found that kind of, you know, don't beat yourself up is what I was hearing from there. Don't beat yourself up. God knows the truth and he knows me better than I know myself. So I found great comfort in that. I was intrigued also by the word pity in there, because I wonder whether Jesus would take that a bit further, because it's one thing feeling pity for someone who's in trouble, but actually Jesus is so much about justice that if you're feeling pitiful for someone, it's like, oh, here, have some money, sort yourself out. But actually Jesus might go a bit further and find out, why is there injustice here?
Yeah.
And what can we do to address that? So actually, rather than just feeling pity, maybe some rage ought to come into that too. Find out why this person is being persecuted. Maybe I'm reading too much into that.
No, I don't think so. And I think that it's also a really good example of how, you know, not every line of scripture says everything, that we need the rest of it, and we need to read it with the echoes of the rest of it. You could also almost imagine that John says makes his questions out loud, and the response is yes, and more than just pity, because of the faith that they are all engaged in, that we are all engaged in.
Yeah. Okay. So keeping an eye on our time slot, can we turn to the reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verse 11 to 18, which has got some famous lines and returns to the theme of sheep. What struck you about this?
So there's, again, some really kind of powerful creedal type statements, or perhaps doctrine type statements, that this is Jesus describing what is actually happening around the Easter weekend, and actually it's easy for us to kind of take that for granted and not interrogate it because we're so sort of familiar with it. But actually, I think that stopping and noticing that, and in incredible clarity, he says, no, I'm skipping right to the end. I'm sorry, that's not helpful. But he says at the end of the reading, the Father loves me because I lay down my life in order to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have the power to lay it down, and I have the power to take it up again. I have received this command from my Father. In few short words, saying something which is completely new, completely incomprehensible, like nothing has ever or will ever happen again in the history of the world. And it's three lines. And I think it really helps us to have some clarity about what Jesus thinks he's doing, about kind of the relational dynamics in the Trinity, but also I think this goes then back to what we were talking about the beating ourselves up in the reading before, because the authority of what Jesus says in those lines is so powerful, and so often I think. So for me, I used to teach preaching, and one of the things I passed on from when I was taught preaching is every sermon has to be about the grace of God. Otherwise, it's a talk about how you ought to be a better Christian. So what I used to teach is the first thing you look for in a passage is where is the grace, and this is the very source of grace. This is Jesus explaining. This is how I have got this. I have got this. I am doing this, and everything else flows from that. And the kind of sense I think is that our shoulders can relax, and that everything then that we do is flowing from that assurance. I've skipped over all the shepherd stuff and gone straight to that. Right. So we must go back.
Yes, well, I have one thing. I do a lot of scriptural reasoning. I don't know if you do that, where you read the scriptures with people of other faiths.
Yeah.
One of the practices is to go through each reading and for everyone in the group to pick out one line that stands out. And the line that struck me from this reading is, I have other sheep, which I think is a really just leaps out of the page to me, especially in an interfaith context as well. So what's Jesus saying?
I thought about interfaith Then too, actually, because I had a conversation after the sermon I preached yesterday in a church in Cambridge, we had a chat afterwards, and one of the things that somebody was saying to me was how they've come to understand that Muslims and Jews sit alongside Christianity and not in opposition, So it's very forefront of my mind when I read this, because it would be a really obvious in interpretation, I think, to think that this is saying there are other flocks, effectively. And I think so much of this kind of runs to our own context, because I probably wouldn't talk about that. I would probably see this as an opportunity to talk about inclusion again. That so probably if I was preaching on the Acts, I'd refer to this in conjunction with the stone that the builders rejected. That this it's one of the examples of Jesus never being of never saying the covenant is done, that there is always another widening. There is always, you're always going to look around you and see that, oh, look, and God made it bigger again. And look, it includes more people again. And we thought that we understood what this faith that we are part of is. And look, here God's love is more expansive and more extraordinary than we understood. And I think that's the direction I take it in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. So we've been through the readings now, and it's already got me thinking about lots of different things I could pursue because I'm preaching on Sunday, as it happens.
Yeah, I'm not,
The
which feels a
following
real
weekend.
waste.
All right, done. Yeah. Absolutely. So that's been super. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. And we wish well to all our colleagues out there who are going to be spreading the word on Sunday. So, Naomi, thank you, and
Thank you.
take care. So, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts and share this episode with your friends. We also have online spaces for further engagement and discussion about faith and politics on X, formerly Twitter, or using Politics in the Pulpit. We also have a Facebook group which you can access through the Joint Public Issues Team's Facebook page or jpit.uk.